It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we check in on the latest state assembly hearing over the investigation into the 2020 election in Wisconsin. First, the Wisconsin DNR recently halted an effort to set a new standard for allowable nitrates in groundwater. Nitrates are the most widespread water contaminant in the state, and the new rule would have targeted farmers spreading manure and fertilizer on their fields, taking a step to curb one of the largest sources of nitrates leaching into groundwater. We're going to talk more about the scope and complexity of the nitrates problem that affects not just Wisconsin, but several neighboring states, as well as water systems downstream. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a problem with nitrates in water in your community, in your well, if you have a well? If you're a farmer, is this something you've thought about? Have you made efforts to reduce runoff of things like manure and fertilizer from your farm? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The state DNR declined a request to be part of this conversation and did not comment to WPR's Danielle Kading when she reported on the proposed rule being dropped last month. Ken Bradbury is director and state geologist with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey and the UW-Madison Division of Extension. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here, Rob.
Can you give us some of the basics, first of all, on nitrates? How widespread is nitrate contamination in Wisconsin waterways?
Well, nitrate is, as you said, probably the most widespread contaminant in Wisconsin groundwater. It's produced, we think, mostly from agricultural practices, from nitrogen fertilizers, also disposal of manure from agricultural animals, and of course also from human septic systems and sludge spreading and some other sources. But it does have it's a pretty ubiquitous contaminant, and it does have some health impacts. There's a groundwater concentration rule of 10 parts per million nitrate as nitrogen, above which you are advised not to drink water, and that's exceeded in many, many private wells in the state. And so that's a concern. And nitrate is very mobile in groundwater, so it doesn't get filtered out by the soil very well at all. And then in surface water, of course, nitrate is a nutrient, and it leads to growth of algae and other things in surface water. And downstream, it all flows into the Mississippi River, down to the Gulf of Mexico, and it's causing dead zones and low oxygen levels in the Gulf of Mexico. So it's not only a Wisconsin problem, but a whole Midwest United States problem.
Now, for people in Wisconsin worried about the health impacts in particular, you mentioned wells. Is this mainly a problem, mainly a health concern for people finding nitrates in their well water?
Yes, we should all be concerned, but for the people on private wells in particular, it is a concern because it does have health impacts for people with small infants, people with compromised immune systems, and so forth. And the drinking water standard of 10 milligrams per liter or parts per million is, as I said, often exceeded in many, many wells. And so it's, while it's not, I'm not a medical doctor, so what I understand is it's not a big concern for most healthy adults, but for infants and small children and people with compromised immune systems, it is an issue.
You are a geologist, and I wanted to ask you some about the geology here. You mentioned nitrates travel pretty well through the soil. They don't get filtered out. I know certain pollutants, depending on your local geology and topography, they can be a lot worse in some places than others. Are there certain types of soil and landscapes that are bigger problems for nitrate runoff getting into groundwater?
Well, we think about, as far as the hydrogeology, we think about vulnerability of the groundwater system, and that's places where there's permeable materials like fractured bedrock near the surface, or sandy materials such as you have in central Wisconsin. These materials of sand and gravel and fractured rock allow groundwater to infiltrate very rapidly, pass through with very little filtration. Areas less vulnerable would be places with a lot of clay in the soil or very thick thick deposits over bedrock. But those can be vulnerable too. But we focus mainly on areas of vulnerable geology like that, with permeable rock or soil or shallow depths to bedrock.
Talking about nitrate pollution in Wisconsin groundwater with Ken Bradbury with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences with nitrate in your own water or in trying to control nitrate runoff, possibly from your farm. That's 800-642-1234. So that brings us all, Ken, to the rule the DNR was working on when it came to trying to prevent that runoff from farms ending up creating this nitrate problem in groundwater. What was laid out in this rule?
Well, that rule identified areas of the landscape across Wisconsin that were vulnerable for a number of different reasons that are in the rule. And then there were different practices that the farmers would have to take at these lands. And they were required to reduce nutrient inputs over many of these areas to certain levels that were thought to cause less harm to the groundwater system. I think the controversial part about that is that it's obviously going to cost money for the farmers to do these different practices. And reducing nutrients is going to reduce crop yields, and that costs money too. So there are a lot of parts to this, but that's the gist of it. It was an attempt to reduce loading to the groundwater system and to the surface, and then to the groundwater system too.
Now the DNR has this on hold. It may have run afoul with something from the state legislature. That's a whole other conversation. That said, without this in place, do we already have any kind of restrictions on the flow of nitrates from the field to the groundwater?
Well, there are certain best management practices that are in place. Although I should say that the best management practices, and by that I refer to there's a different calculations that are made on how much fertilizer a crop needs, depending on the soil and the crop type and so forth. These are in place, but they are really designed to maximize yield of the crop. They weren't originally designed to protect the environment. And so we have these rules that are really kind of outdated now, and they're being used for a purpose they weren't really designed for. Beyond that, there really aren't a lot of restrictions on application of manure or fertilizers other than these economic constraints.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeanette is with us in Warren, Illinois. Jeanette, hi.
Hi. I'd just like to let folks know I grew up on a dairy farm in northeastern Iowa, and we did a lot of strip cropping and a lot of crop rotation. But one of the things that isn't often mentioned is the huge amounts of unnecessary fertilizer people are putting on their lawns. And if you want to have a green lawn, it's actually greener if you let it get a little taller. And it's wonderful if you would plant natives and have those as buffer strips rather than having your ditches and things and your property boundaries mowed down to the shorter than golf courses. My husband's a beekeeper, and we have a lawn that includes Dutch clover, which keeps it green and fertile. We've never applied fertilizer, so that's not getting into the water. So we have things that the bees like. Granted, those aren't natives, but they're not aggressive non-natives. And you can do a lot of different things just within small neighborhoods and large cities.
Jeanette, thanks a lot for the call. Ken, I've heard concerns about phosphorus, I think, in lawn fertilizers. Is lawn fertilizer part of the story with nitrates as well?
Oh, sure. Of course it is. It's particularly in urban or suburban areas where people have a lot of lawns. In the big picture, though, the area of lawns is quite small compared to the area, for example, of cornfields. So in the big picture, it's probably not the big deal, but locally it can be, of course.
Jeanette, thanks for that call. We're talking to Ken Bradbury, director and state geologist with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey and the UW-Madison Division of Extension. We're looking at nitrate contamination in groundwater in Wisconsin and beyond after the DNR stopped moving forward with a new proposal for a rule related to spreading manure and fertilizer on farms. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. What do you want to know about the use and necessity for fertilizers and how they relate to this nitrate pollution? Are nitrate pollutants a problem in your local groundwater, maybe in the well for your house or your local municipal water supply? If you are a farmer, have you taken steps to try to reduce the flow of nutrients from your farm into neighboring areas and into the groundwater ultimately? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Ken Bradbury, director and state geologist with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey and the UW-Madison Division of Extension. We're talking about the problem of nitrate contamination in Wisconsin groundwater. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your concerns about nitrates at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ken, if someone's concerned about nitrates in their local water, maybe in their own well, but they don't really know, like, what can they do to test? What can they do to watch out and make sure it's not a problem for them?
Well, that's a great question, Rob. I want to make it very clear to people that if you have your own well, and many rural people like me have their own well, nobody is paying attention to your well except you. And so it's really important that you have your well tested occasionally. We recommend once a year for things like bacteria and nitrate. And in most parts of the state, it's easy to get a test like that. Usually the county health department or your local village health department will know how to do that and where to take a sample. For instance, here in Dane County, the county health department will arrange for you to take a sample and have it analyzed.
When I was a kid in Michigan, we had our well tested. They said there's too many nitrates. Don't drink your water. We got one of those water things where they dropped off the water. We drank out of that. I mean, is that the only solution for someone if they test high for nitrates?
Well, in some cases it may be. There are some filtration devices that may be applicable too. You need to understand how they work and what device might be most appropriate for your situation. In some cases, it may be possible to re-drill or modify the well, although that can be expensive. And it may be useful to try to figure out where the source is. If you're in the middle of an agricultural area, maybe it's a dispersed source and you can't really tell. But if there's something right up gradient from your well, you might be able to change the local land use. But it can be a challenging problem, that's for sure.
Now, that's the local well. You mentioned this problem keeps going downstream, down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico. What kind of effect do nitrates have in a body of water like the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, the nitrates, as I said, are a nutrient. So they cause things like algae blooms. And those, in turn, end up using all the oxygen up that's in the water column and having some bad chemical effects on the water that eventually affects life in the water body. So if you look at the Mississippi River drainage system, when you have all these agricultural areas in the upper Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, all draining into this river, the Mississippi, that's eventually getting to the Gulf of Mexico. Now we see offshore of the Gulf of Mexico, these big dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico that really can be traced back to our Midwestern use of nutrients on the farmland. So it's a really interesting national problem.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Howard is with us in Trade Lake. Howard, hello.
Hello. Yeah, I'm up here in Burnett County in the town of Trade Lake. And we have an issue here that relates exactly to this. We have an outfit coming out of Iowa, and they want to build a hog CAFO in our township. And this hog CAFO will produce a quarter million piglets a year and 9 million gallons of manure. And this is right along the Trade Lake River and along the Trade Lake Lake system, which flows into the St. Croix River, which is a National Scenic Riverway. And as your guest has been speaking here about nitrates, the amount of nitrates flowing into the National Scenic Riverway will change the character of the river. And the kicker of this, a guy from SORP is trying to cite this thing, and he lied on the application. He does not have the authority to sign the application to the DNR for the WEDIS permit, and which is a discharge permit. And the DNR doesn't seem to care.
Howard, I don't want to get too much in the technicality of permitting this thing, but Howard's point, a CAFO, a concentrated animal feeding operation, maybe coming into his community. We've talked mostly about plant crops with manure and fertilizer spread on them. Can do these large-scale livestock operations affect the nitrate picture here?
Well, they certainly can, and I, like you, I don't know about this particular proposal, but there has to be a plan for managing the waste from CAFO, any CAFO. That usually involves land spreading at some rate around it, and then there's also the potential of leakage from a lagoon or wherever they store the manure. So both those things are part of the approval process that DNR has. And I don't know the details of this one, so I can't comment on that. But certainly those are potential sources, yes.
Howard, thanks for the call. We're talking to Ken Bradbury with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey about nitrate pollution in Wisconsin groundwater and beyond. Ken, big picture, this was one solution the DNR offered, restricting some farming practices. What would you see as the key things that would need to be done to cut down on nitrates ending up in Wisconsin groundwater?
I'm glad you asked that, Rob, because even if this current plan had passed, it wouldn't have solved the problem. It would have helped a little, but it wouldn't have solved the problem. And that's because this is a huge dilemma for our state. We have this groundwater problem, and we have a standard that we're trying to meet, but we also have a very big and important agricultural industry that's kind of the foundation of our state's economy. That has to operate too, and it has to be profitable. And those two things are kind of incompatible, really. And that's a very difficult problem that people in our state are wrestling with right now. So there is no single solution that's going to solve this problem.
That said, what are some of the individual separate solutions that would at least point us in the right direction?
Well, one thing that's probably a little controversial to say is that we need to maybe reduce our expectations for crop yields, which will allow us to use less nutrient fertilizers, and that can be a tough pill for people to swallow. Other things like planting cover crops and thinking a lot more about how we use our land are all useful here. But the bottom line is we may not be on a sustainable path with the way we're doing things right now. And then the final thing is pay attention, as I said before, pay attention to your well. Make sure that the other side of this besides the input is what you are actually drinking. And let's make sure that our wells are properly constructed and drilled so that people are getting good quality water out of them.
We heard from Julian Superior, who wonders if human waste contributes to the problem. And I think you mentioned septic systems as one possible contributor. Do we humans directly play a role here?
Well, sure, of course. The human waste does contain nitrogen and other things, and that contributes to the problem as well. Although when you look at the scale, the difference in scale, just in terms of, say, animal units, it's not nearly as big as the agricultural component, but it is a component, and I don't mean to minimize it.
in our last couple of minutes, actually, we've got time for one more caller. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So there's a farmer. His name's Mark Shepherd. He's in Wisconsin. He's been going around the world advocating a new method of farming, basically, which is returning to the old method of having smaller farms, kind of doing like what they do in France, building hedgerows and berms to keep water on the properties, creating retention ponds so that the water that falls just doesn't all run downstream and then end up creating flooding issues in Iowa and, you know, everywhere else downstream. And it's really a way to, they've discovered that it's used less pesticides. And so you don't need glyphosate and whatever else for ripening fruits, and you get a different variety and different mix. And so
I gotcha. Marcus, don't have much time left. I want to jump in. I have heard Mark Shepherd on the Larry Mueller show. Ken, are there different models of agriculture we could look at in our last minute that might have less of that runoff?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that's a great thing to look at. But again, as I said before, that requires a kind of a cultural change, and those things are difficult.
Thanks for that call. Marcus and Ken, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks a lot. You're glad to do it, Rob.
That's Ken Bradbury, director and state geologist with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey and the UW-Madison Division of Extension. We talked to him today about nitrate contamination in Wisconsin water after the DNR dropped its latest effort to move forward with a new rule about spreading manure on vulnerable soil. Coming up after the news, we explore the latest from the Republican-backed investigation of the 2020 election here in Wisconsin. And we have an ongoing conversation that we'll get to also today. New survey of some of the most common pet names out there. We want to hear your pet's name and where you get your pet names from. You can tell us about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we want to hear about your pet's names. We're taking your calls about what you named your pet, why you picked it, what your pet means to you. That's coming up next. Now, state lawmakers took a close look at former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman's investigation into the 2020 election in Wisconsin with a hearing last week. The testimony included heated exchanges between Gableman and members of the Assembly's Committee on Campaigns and Elections, including Democratic State Representative Mark Spreitzer of Beloit.
It seems that you are firmly in the lane of suggesting that the outcome of the election should have been overturned.
Now, I'm going to stop you right there, Mr. Spreitzer. I am not going to let you put words in my mouth for your cheap political advancement. Stop it.
You hired Mr.
Hoyer. I never said anything about overturning any election. Stop making things up, Mark.
Then why have you hired Mr. Hoyer?
Your constituents deserve better.
Why have you hired Mr. Hoyer?
Shame on you.
Why? Shame on you. Why have you hired Mr. Hoyer, who tried to overturn the will of the people of Wisconsin?
Learning more about what came out of that hearing and where Gableman's investigation is headed, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this election investigation led by the former state Supreme Court Justice created by Republicans in the Assembly? Do you think the 2020 election needs to be investigated further? Are you satisfied with the other election reviews and court challenges and audits that haven't found problems in the state's election that would have changed the result? Or do you want to see more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She's also co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with the basics. What was the assigned mission from Republicans in the Assembly for former Justice Gableman with this investigation?
So Assembly Speaker Robin Voss unveiled Gabelman as the head of this investigation at the state Republican convention over the summer. And the word that he used at the time was shenanigans, that Gabelman was going to look into potential shenanigans related to the 2020 election in Wisconsin. So sort of starting from a premise of there were shenanigans that need to be uncovered. And this was coming, of course, after the state had done a number of audits already that are required in state law, a partial presidential recount, and all of those lawsuits that we saw from various Republican-backed entities that all failed to uncover any shenanigans or any proof of widespread fraud or wrongdoing. But Voss said at the time, there needed to be more done to ensure the public had faith in elections in Wisconsin. So that was sort of Gabelman's, you know, task at the outset. Look at what happened in the election, report back, tell us if anything went wrong.
One question has been, who is on Gabelman's staff in this? We're starting to get some answers now. What do we know about the team that he's hired with the money granted him by the state legislature?
Well, it has taken quite a while to get a list of employees for Gabelman's effort. He really kind of dragged his feet on this. He didn't want to share information about who his staff members were. He acknowledged that there were several of them, but didn't want to disclose them. We just last week got several names, and you heard kind of, you played that clip at the top there of the conflict between State Representative Mark Spreitzer, who's a Democrat, and Gabelman over one of the staff in particular and his ties to lawsuits that sought to overturn 2020 election results. And that's kind of a theme that's played out with a lot of the folks that have come to light that are associated with this effort. It's a lot of people who have expressed public opinions that the election wasn't conducted fairly, that have been behind efforts to overturn results, questioning things, advancing ideas that have been disproven. So there's a lot of pushback from folks outside of the probe saying that the probe is biased just based on who Gabelman has chosen to be a part of the effort.
Now, we heard a taste of that assembly committee hearing. What else, apart from some dramatic moments, what else came out of that hearing? What did we learn there?
Well, it was a much shorter hearing, interestingly. So this was just the second time that Gabelman spoke before state lawmakers since his effort was launched over the summer. And the first time he went before a Senate committee, and it was several hours long. They went into the evening. They talked for a really long time. This committee was just an hour long. That's the amount of time that Gabelman allotted to lawmakers to talk about this. So a big part of the committee hearing was that back and forth that you heard, concerns about, you know, who the staffers are, who's involved. And then the other big conflict right now about this investigation is the testimony that Gabelman is seeking from election officials across the state. The information that he wants, the in-person interviews that he wants, and how he wants to go about doing them. So there was certainly some back and forth about that as well.
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, about the ongoing Republican-appointed investigation into last year's 2020 election in Wisconsin. You mentioned that that conflict with mayors in particular, a court filing, in effect, threatening to jail two mayors in Wisconsin. Do I have that right, Laurel? Are you there, Laurel? Seem to have lost Laurel White for the moment. We are talking about the ongoing Gabelman investigation into the 2020 elections. We'll give her a quick call, I imagine. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts or concerns about this investigation? Are you glad it's happening? Do you think it's redundant given other recounts and audits that have already happened? What do you want to see happen next? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. The This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, learning more about a contentious hearing before the state assembly last week between Michael Gableman and Democratic lawmakers about the ongoing investigation in last November's election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Laurel, a conflict between former Justice Gableman and a couple of mayors of cities in Wisconsin and a threat to potentially to jail them. What's going on?
That's right. So what's going on there is that Gableman had subpoenaed several weeks ago five mayors in Wisconsin, the mayors of the five largest cities in the state, to talk to them about election administration in their communities during the 2020 election. A big part of the conversation there are grants that each of these cities received from an organization called the Center for Tech and Civic Life. It's a group associated with Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. Republicans have pushed back on these grants for a long time, saying that they unduly influenced how elections were run in these communities, that it was inappropriate. And so Gableman has sought out conversations with these mayors. But it has been rocky from the very beginning. He scaled back the documents that he was asking for from these communities because the scope was incredibly broad. And now there's conflict back and forth about the in-person interviews and how those are going to happen and if they're going to happen. And two mayors in particular have really had conflict with Gableman. The mayor of Green Bay, Eric Genrich, and the mayor of Madison, Satya Rhodes Conway. And as you said, Gableman is, you know, he's filed a lawsuit. He's essentially seeking, potential jail time for them for refusing to testify in this probe. And their pushback is twofold. One, they say that there hasn't been clear communication about when and how they were supposed to provide this in-person testimony. So they were sort of unclear on whether this was moving forward at all because of some changes that were happening. And secondly, and this is coming from Rhodes Conway, she says she wants her testimony to be in public. She says, I'll speak to you, I'll provide whatever information you want, but I want it to be in front of a legislative committee. I want it to be in public. I want people to be able to see and hear the questions that you ask me and how I respond. And Gableman says he doesn't want to do that. He wants the questions to be in private. He says, you know, doing it in public could compromise the investigation. It could give away some of the things that they're looking into. And he says that that wouldn't be good. That's not how these things should be done. So there is, as I mentioned, pending litigation about this. And there's going to be a hearing later this month.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Liz is with us in Waukesha. Liz, hi.
Hi there. I have a problem with the Republican agenda. It seems to me between the gerrymandering of maps and the shackling of Governor Evers' power during their lame duck session, and now kind of a secret sort of investigation into a election that has already been probed quite extensively, that leads me to be suspicious. What is it that they're seeking, or what is it they're hoping to find, or are they going to twist things this time so that it appears that there was some fraud? I just don't trust their agenda. It's too sinister, in my opinion.
Liz, thanks for the wall. Liz, for the call. Liz referred Laurel to the other audits and things that have gone on. Can you remind us of the more recent the audits up to this date, including the Legislative Audit Bureau's audit?
The Legislative Audit Bureau report, which comes from the nonpartisan legislative office that conducts audits for the state, that was just released in late October. And it found, again, like a number of other things that came before it, that there wasn't any widespread fraud, there wasn't any wrongdoing, nothing that would have changed the outcome of the election in Wisconsin. It did point out several areas where state laws could be changed and updated, state policies that have been in place from the State Elections Commission that should be updated. And so it has caused, even without saying that there was widespread fraud or wrongdoing, kind of turmoil in state government because lawmakers are pushing for changes. They're criticizing the Elections Commission, saying that you know, even the administrator of the Elections Commission needs to step down because of some of the things that were pointed out in the audit. So that's something that's taken up a lot of space in state government over the past several weeks, and very separate from this Gableman investigation. But again, it did not find anything that would have changed the outcome of the election, just some suggestions for changes moving forward to some state policies.
Liz, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Brad joins us next in Arpin. Brad, hello. I think we lost Brad, is what that ding meant. Okay, we'll go to Jimmy in Valley Junction now. Jimmy, hello.
Good afternoon. I said initially the cost of this was estimated at $800,000. And my question is, how open-ended is the length of this investigation and the cost? And where do they actually appropriate this money from that they're using to conduct it? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Laurel, the costs and how it's being paid for.
Yeah, so the cost is it's just a little bit shy of $700,000. And that's been approved by the state legislature already. That was the initial budget, taxpayer funded. And the question about how long the investigation is going to go on and if it's going to need additional funding is a great question, and one that we've posed to Assembly Speaker Voss, who spearheaded this whole thing. And he says that he hopes it doesn't need to go on much longer. He hasn't weighed in on what potential additional costs may be. There are actually a number of requests out from media outlets, from different groups, trying to get more information about the contracts and the agreements for this investigation. And Voss has refused to release those publicly, citing some of the similar reasons that Gableman did when he said he didn't want testimony to happen in public when he talks to those mayors. So we don't know a lot about, you know, what happens if this goes long. The investigation's already gone a bit longer than folks expected. It was expected to be wrapped up around the same time as that Legislative Audit Bureau audit that ended in late October. So there is a definite possibility here that more money, in addition to the roughly $700,000 that's already been approved, would need to be allocated for this if it's going to go on.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White about the ongoing Republican-appointed investigation of last year's elections. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Want to give a listen to former Justice Gableman talking earlier this week. Here's a listen.
My work and my employees will be judged by one thing, and that is the finished work product. And right now, what is preventing the finished work product is the fearful running and hiding of those government officials who do not want to be held accountable and who do not want to tell the public what they did with the Zuckerberg money and why they did it.
And Laurel, that gets back into, in part, the dispute with mayors. But there's been a bunch of kind of legal stumbles along the way. Some of the initial requests were from a John Delta pseudonym email, right? There's been a lot of weird legal glitches that have made communication really weird between all parties.
Yeah, there have absolutely been bumps in the road. As you mentioned, some initial emails to local election officials came from a Gmail account associated with someone named John Delta. There were concerns about that account being secure, whether it was legitimate in the requests it was sending to these local officials for information. And there's been that pushback that I mentioned, you know, the mayors of Madison and Green Bay, their in-person testimony, the lawsuit over that, Gableman threatening to jail them if they don't agree to testify in person. There's a separate lawsuit that has to do with the administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission and whether she is going to testify in person and provide information to Gableman. And that's a lawsuit that involves the state attorney general, because in his capacity, Josh Call represents the Wisconsin Elections Commission because it's a state agency. And his argument is that the Gableman investigation has a lot of legal shortfalls, that there are a lot of problems there, that it's acting outside the legislature's authority, that it's attempting to be a criminal investigation, which it shouldn't be doing. Also pushing for in-person testimony if testimony is going to be given. And a hearing in that case is kind of backed right up against a hearing in the case with the mayors. And those are both scheduled for later this month. So as you mentioned, certainly kind of legal conversations, legal conflicts from the beginning, and looks like more to come.
Let's go back to our callers now. Tony is on the line in Tomahawk. Tony, hi.
Hi. My concern is that Democrats in the legislature have been so timid in trying to play by polite rules. Gableman couldn't even run for Supreme Court justice again because he's incompetent. He can't file a legal brief. You mentioned glitches and, legal misstatements all over the place. The guy is not competent. The whole thing is just an exercise in trying to please Donald Trump, apparently. It's just a bunch of noise, and the Democrats need to talk back to this and say, this is just crap. This is just nonsense, a waste of taxpayer money. They need to stop allowing it to happen and demand that the money be repaid back. These people are not investigators any more than the cyber ninjas were in Arizona. This is just foolishness.
Tony, thanks for the call. What are we hearing from Democrats, Laurel?
Well, we are certainly hearing that from Democrats. Governor Tony Evers has expressed frustration, said that it's a waste of time, it's a waste of money. The thing is, Republicans have the control in the state legislature. They have the strong majorities, and there really isn't anything that Governor Evers or the Democratic minority can do practically to block this from moving forward. They can voice that criticism, which they have, but just because of the strong Republican majority in state government right now, they have the, you know, kind of the autonomy, the ability to move forward with things like this. So that's just kind of the way things stand right now. In terms of Gableman's competence, that's something that Democrats have brought up as well. Gableman has been open about his lack of knowledge, personal knowledge about election administration in Wisconsin. He said in an interview that he doesn't really understand the process, doesn't understand the intricacies of it. And Democrats have pushed back and said, well, why should we trust someone who's coming from a basis of, you know, self-admitted low level of knowledge to look into something like this? So Democrats have been pushing back, but there are limits on what they can do with that pushback.
Tony, thanks for calling. Fawn joins us next in Madison. Fawn, hi.
I agree wholeheartedly with the previous caller. I think I'm completely alarmed. I think this is a very, I think it's an alarming threat to democracy that all this insistence on secrecy of Gableman, on the part of Gableman and Boss and the others, that all the secrecy is just going to drive, you know, the Washington Post has the motto, democracy dies in darkness. And that's exactly what they're trying to do, trying to pull all these shenanigans and using these tactics of harassment and intimidation by threatening jail time. That's like the caller said, it's just a lot of noise. The entire matter is trumped up, I know, no pun intended, is just fabricated. And it's just to make a lot of noise and banging pots and pans for no good reason. I think there should be a suit brought against Gableman at all for wasting taxpayer money. If the state can't do it, possibly a civil group could do it.
Vaughn, thanks for the call. There is, I think, a suit that's been filed against Assembly Speaker Voss or trying to get a court to declare him in contempt of court, Laurel, for not sharing some of the information you were talking about earlier.
That's absolutely right. And that's moving forward just as these lawsuits about, you know, the in-person testimony are moving forward. So we're going to continue to get decisions to have the judiciary weigh in on this. But there haven't been any cases trying to block the probe from moving mm-hmm. forward in a way other than, you know, the conflict over the in-person testimony.
Thanks for that call. Laurel, just at our last less than a minute now, what are you watching for next? A lot of moving parts here.
Yeah, I think those decisions are going to be a big factor moving forward, whether these local officials are going to have to provide in-person testimony, whether that testimony is going to be in public or behind closed doors, as Gableman wants it to be. And then just obviously keeping a really close eye on if this does move forward, how much longer it's going to take. This was supposed to be wrapped up in the fall. So if this stretches into 2022, how long, what is Gableman looking into, and how much additional money might taxpayers be on the hook for it?
Laurel, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter, co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. She was with us today to talk about the latest in former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman's probe of Wisconsin's 2020 election. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on the morning show, it's this week's edition of Ask a Contractor with affordable home repairs and additions that can make a big difference without breaking the bank. Find out more tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. As we heard last week from Wisconsin folklore and paranormal expert Chad Lewis, last night was a time for a visit for some of us from the Krampus, the Christmas season guy in Northern European folklore who punishes the naughty by hitting them with a stick. That's just half the story, though. A couple of Central Time producers point out there's a double tradition, kind of a good cop, bad cop of the holiday season. Today is St. Nicholas Day, and some European settlers in Wisconsin carried on the tradition that St. Nick would give out candy on the evening before to kids on the nice list. Producers Bill Martins and Dean Canetter both report having candy cane-shaped containers filled with candy for the occasion, though neither said specifically where they came from. I guess they're both on the good list. No one on the team is reported yet being hit by the Krampus, though maybe they wouldn't admit it if they have. Anyhow, still hoping somebody's going to share some of that candy with me. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.